Hi, and welcome to my podcast series, The New Abnormal. I'm Sean P. Lodishenesi, researcher, author, and speaker from Brand Positive. As a researcher, I've spent 20 years conducting ethnographic interviews on global projects. Along the way, I've been lucky enough to have met some amazing people, from psychologists to activists to creatives, some of whom I'll be talking to in this series. I'm also the author of The Post-Truth Business, which focused on trust, empathy, and privacy, while my second book, Influencers and Revolutionaries, looked into innovation, behavioural change, and the climate crisis. So, I hope you enjoy the interviews, and if so, please tell your friends, leave a rating, and watch out for our other episodes. Now, without further delay, let's crack on with today's podcast. So today I'm really pleased to be joined by an absolutely dynamic thinker, Andrew Koppelman, who's the John Paul Stevens Professor of Law, Professor of Political Science and Philosophy Department affiliated faculty at Northwestern University. He's been published and quoted in the New York Times more than 20 times, also the Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, Chicago Tribune, USA Today, Boston Globe, International Herald Tribune, New Republic, The Hill, and many others. He's also appeared on CNN's The Situation Room, NBC's Today, Chicago Tonight, Fox Chicago Perspective, and many others. His scholarship focuses on issues at the intersection of law and political philosophy. He's written more than 100 scholarly articles and 7 books, the latest of which I have right in front of me now, which I've been reading with real interest, is Burning Down the House: How Libertarian Philosophy Was Corrupted by Delusion and Greed. To which one can only say, have you met Boris Johnson? So anyway, Andrew, hi, and how are you?
I'm very happy to be here.
Andrew, before we get into how libertarian philosophy was indeed corrupted by delusion and greed, perhaps we can just do the usual thing, but always fascinating to pause and just go back through, in this instance, your background, you know, how you got to where you are now and whether it was a straight road or a windy one that led you here.
I was a little windy. I started out as a graduate student in political science, which I did just because I had a friend who was a professional student and I liked the way he lived. And I thought that I wanted to try that for a while myself. And I ended up getting a law degree as well as a PhD in political philosophy. And I found that I liked the academic work better than I liked lawyering. I tried that a couple of summers. And so I had written enough that I could get a job as a teacher. And so that's what I have done all my life. I got interested in libertarianism specifically because I teach constitutional law, and I got interested in the arguments surrounding the constitutionality of Barack Obama's healthcare legislation, which was alleged to be an outrageous intrusion on liberty, which struck me as a strange understanding of liberty. It was alleged that it violated the Constitution. And as I tried to understand why federal courts were adopting what I thought were terrible arguments, it became clear to me that both the lawyers and many of the judges were animated by a strange philosophy of liberty. Now, I'm trained in political philosophy. Political philosophy is about the appropriate deployment of the coercive power of the state. Law is just political philosophy with guns. We actually enforce particular visions of the appropriate deployment of the coercive power of the state. And so if you're a libertarian, you are going to want to radically constrain the state. And so in my earlier book, The Tough Luck Constitution and the Assault on Healthcare Reform, I tried to show how libertarianism was undergirding the challenge to Obamacare and why it was bad political philosophy. But when I finished that book, I thought I had unfinished business with libertarianism. I wanted to understand it better than I did. And there just wasn't a good book for the general reader that described what libertarianism was, where it came from, the different forms that it takes, and why it has deteriorated into the dangerous forms that it takes now. So I wrote this book because that general introduction needed to be written.
Mm. So interesting. I mean, I have to say, just going back slightly before we get into the book, because I mean, the book, obviously, I mean, it's extraordinary read. I mean, certainly on this side of the Atlantic, I mean, as we're recording this, I'm in Brighton, England, just by the sea, and you're in Chicago, which is normally an extremely windy and chilly sort of location. Over here, certainly, for a UK audience to try and get their heads around that sort of a libertarian perspective that saw essentially sort of healthcare, certainly free healthcare, being an absolutely appalling idea is so difficult for us to understand. You know, we look to America in so many ways with a sense of positivity and respect and the opposites in many, many other areas. But certainly when it comes to healthcare, it just seems extraordinary.
That's right. Even Margaret Thatcher did not propose to abolish the National Health Service.
Indeed. And with regards to Thatcher and also with regards to your book, perhaps starting somewhere, what about this with, as the old anecdote has it, during a famous Conservative Party policy meeting, Margaret Thatcher removed a copy of Hayek's Constitution of Liberty from her handbag, slammed it down the table and declared, "This is what we believe." Where does one start? Over to you.
Where does one start? Well, Hayek's big claim was that the best way to allocate decisions about what to produce is markets and prices. So Hayek wrote The Road to Serfdom in 1944, really attacking the program of the British Labour Party, which at that time was arguing for the nationalization of heavy industry and of the main means of production and in favor of central economic planning. That was the platform of the Labour Party. Hayek argued that central economic planning was going to be wasteful and tyrannical. And it fit very nicely with Thatcher's program of basically relaxing political constraints on the economy. She thought, as Hayek had thought, that this would produce a wealthier, more prosperous Britain. And she also thought, as Hayek thought, that while some people are going to lose out in a free market economy, government can't do anything about that, or else we will be on a slippery slope to socialism, with the baleful consequences that we're seeing even now. There are coal mining areas in Wales that have never come back from Thatcher. Broadly, what I want to argue about Hayek, who I talk about in the beginning of the book, is that he's absolutely right about central economic planning. It's a bad idea, but that doesn't mean that we have to leave people to the mercy of the market. There's lots of intermediate stages between absolute central planning and just telling people, tough luck, you're on your own. France allowed its coal industry to disappear by finding new jobs for all of the people who already had jobs and just not hiring any new people, but making sure that nobody was left jobless and destitute. So I understand how much the English are offended by being compared unfavorably to the French about anything. But here, I think that they did a much better job than Thatcher of addressing the exact same problem, which is that it doesn't make sense. It didn't make sense then, and it makes even less sense now for Europeans to be mining coal.
And just that point you're making there about imagining sort of a not leaving people destitute and all the rest of it. You know, what an outrageous idea.
Markets are supposed to make us rich. That's what markets are good for. Markets have accomplished quite a lot of that. That's the respect in which Hayek was right. But Hayek was much too afraid of state efforts to ameliorate that. And Hayek got crankier and crankier about this in his old age, which was the time when Thatcher took power.
I think one of the obviously the key analogies that you use in the book links around and focuses on a story about fire in South Fulton, Tennessee.
Yes.
So perhaps just take us through that, which you use as a prism to illustrate and illuminate the story.
Okay. In 2010, while the Obamacare debate was happening in the United States, in South Fulton, Tennessee, there was an arrangement in the county. The county did not have its own fire department. It contracted with a nearby town and said that each individual homeowner would pay a fee to the town to insure against fire. And so each household paid the local fire department their fee. But this old man, Gene Kranick, had 1 year forgot to pay the fee. He had paid it previously, but, you know, he's getting old. He forgot. And his house caught fire. And they called, his wife called the fire department. And she was told, sorry, we're not going to come. You forgot to pay your fee. And eventually the fire department came to make sure that the fire didn't spread to his neighbor's house. But his house burned down. And there was a debate in the public press afterward about whether the fire department had done the right thing. And it was clear at the time that the debate was really a proxy for the Obamacare debate, mm-hmm. whether it's legitimate for the state to protect people from undeserved misfortunes. And people on the left and right both agreed that this was the true face of libertarianism. People on the right said, yes, we've got to have more of this stuff. It promotes more self-reliance. And people on the left said, this shows what's wrong with capitalism. We need to pursue people and not profits. And this is not what libertarianism looked like in its original form. Hayek, who we were just talking about, had no objection to tax-supported fire departments. You can have a tax-supported fire department without central economic planning of the whole market. So I was curious how we had gotten from Hayek's ideas, which in some respects were quite sensible, to this completely callous indifference to the misfortunes of other people, which was manifest in the Obamacare litigation, where idealistic lawyers tried very hard to take health care away from 20 million people.
It just seems staggering, doesn't it? I mean, literally, it is so difficult for someone sort of raised with the NHS to just to sort of believe that people actually would seriously do that.
Well, libertarianism is a curiously American thing, even though its principal proponents actually came to America from elsewhere. Hayek is an Austrian, and the novelist Ayn Rand was Russian. Each one of those had bad experiences with central economic planning. And when they came to the United States, they had trouble seeing distinctions. So, Ayn Rand looked at John Kennedy and she saw Joseph Stalin.
Yep. Extraordinary. Just looking perhaps at this in another couple of ways, I've been looking at some of the reviews of the book. I mean, taking one from the care of the Institute of Economic Affairs, who I understand are a right-wing think tank, an American right-wing think tank. Just a couple of comments that they make are this. So some critics of free market liberalism like Burke or John Rawls are insightful and thought-provoking, while others like Nancy McLean or Thomas Piketty tend to be wide off the mark. In Burning Down the House, Andrew Koppelman falls somewhere in between the two. That's what they say. So this, I think, would be fascinating to hear your perspectives on, Andrew, with your sort of a philosophy sort of a hat on. So Koppelman appeals to our moral intuitions. So for the same purpose, I, as in the critic, will pose a question highlighting the other extreme. If a house was on fire and nobody was willing to put it out, would it be legitimate to enslave a person to do so?
No, obviously not. But this is another example of the collapsing of distinctions that I just talked about with Rand. Because there are two possibilities. One is that I pay a small additional amount in income taxes to sustain a fire department. There's just, a number is deducted from my paycheck. So I receive a smaller paycheck than I otherwise would. The other is that men with guns come and make me their slave and make me work for them. Now, it seems to me that those two things are different, that they're not the same thing. And if you think that they're the same thing, I think you're radically confused and don't see what's in front of you.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, another one, just as, by the way, one always loves to look at reviews on Amazon and how long have we got to talk about that, but sort of a before and against. So certainly a four described the book as a nuanced analysis of ideas used like clubs against others. No man is a villain in his own eyes. Mm-hmm. This neatly summarizes the many overwhelmingly white, overwhelmingly male, disproportionately well-off proponents of radical libertarianism in American culture. Koppelman does an amazing job of walking us through the complex fine points of various sophisticated, and in the case of Ayn Rand, naive and superficial libertarian philosophers and the many vulgar and unnecessary cruel misappropriations that their followers make of their ideas. On the minor side, whoever wrote this, talking about, looking at it as a Trojan horse for the book's primary message, which is that libertarianism and even classical liberalism are dangerous, infantile and wrong. Whoa. Moving on to, again, I think the sort of the Thatcherite angle on this, which is so interesting, again, certainly on this side of the Atlantic. Could you just give us your viewpoint on, I've heard, again, very, very famous or infamous statements and how that was reported rightly or wrongly or whatever. So there's no such thing as society and how that point, again, was taken.
Well, I think that the basic perspective there is that it is not possible for us to have a common collective will. There are just individuals pursuing individual ends. But even Thatcher didn't believe that. She thought, for example, that it was legitimate for the state to pursue certain projects that were redistributive and made some people better off, like free public schooling. Thatcher did not propose to abolish that, even though that was redistributive, and that's a common project of society. So yep. If the claim is that all there is markets and individual preferences, we have to collectively decide how to use our collective power, the power of the state. And Thatcher was not shy about using the coercive power of the state. She used it quite vigorously in the Falklands War. Mm-hmm. So, it's a cute phrase, but kind of crumbles from analysis. She wanted to say that the set of collective ends needed to be narrower than some of her political opponents proposed, but that's a much more nuanced idea.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, perhaps just looking at a couple of your previous titles, because again, they sound so interesting. So perhaps just take us back. I know you mentioned it briefly, but The Tough Luck Constitution, The Assault on Healthcare Reform. So just again, just to be clear about the route into that and how that differs from the latest title.
Well, I wanted to argue that the particular conception of liberty behind the attack on Obamacare was the idea that in a fair society, if you get sick and you can't afford to pay for it, that's your tough luck. And it would be unjust for the government to do anything to remedy that tough luck with taxation. So, I don't think that anybody else has just monitored the steps in the argument. One question that arose about the Obamacare litigation is why didn't Obama anticipate it? And the reason why he and Congress didn't anticipate it is that nobody thought it up until 2 weeks before the Senate was going to vote on the bill. It took the libertarians that long to come up with their argument. I don't think anybody had noticed that before my book. So the basic upshot of the book is to show how weird and novel the constitutional theory was. Mm. Now, since then, the Supreme Court has moved further to the right because Donald Trump got 3 appointments to the court. Yep. And so I would say now there is no constitutional theory that the political right offers, however crazy, that is not going to get a respectful hearing from the court.
Mm-hmm. But on that point you mentioned there, by the way, about the Supreme Court, now I know that you are the John Paul Stevens Professor of Law, along with at the university. For those, again, on this side of the Atlantic and indeed elsewhere that aren't familiar with who he was, perhaps just a bit about that?
John Paul Stevens was a justice on the U.S. Supreme Court. He was appointed by Gerald Ford. He retired only a few years ago and died very recently. And he was a graduate of the law school where I teach, the Northwestern Law School. And at one point, a group of his fellow alums got together and contributed the money to endow a chair, which gives me some additional research support. And it's an honorific that a professor gets after some record of scholarly accomplishment after getting tenure. It is the case that once people get tenure, appeals to their vanity is a good way to get work out of them. And so that's the basis for the chair.
Okay, fine. Okay, and so looking at the world around you then, so come on, here we are. A lot of people have been saying this year, because there are no major elections in most of the major locations, therefore we've got a bit of a sort of hiatus this year before things go absolutely crazy or not further down the line. So when you're looking around you at the moment in terms of American culture and society, perhaps just talk about some of the things that are interesting you at the moment. What are you noticing and concerned about or viewing? Noting curtains, etc.
Well, I'm quite worried about the current Supreme Court, which seems to me to be a good deal less constrained in pursuing a conservative agenda than a court that has respect for the law ought to be engaging with. And so pretty much everything that I've written since the book was finished has been one or another analysis of the court and its work, showing that, in part, its libertarian tendencies. It has radically hamstrung the administrative state. It has said, for example, that the Occupational Safety and Health Administration can't require workers in jobs where they work in closed spaces to be vaccinated for COVID, even though it's pretty clear that that would save lives. The court has been quite skeptical of restrictions on pollution, restrictions on carbon. One of the things I talk about in the last part of the book is the way in which libertarian ideology has impaired the United States' ability to respond to climate change, which there were serious Republican proposals to address in the 1990s, and the George H.W. Bush administration was considering it, and Charles Koch, then as now, the most influential of libertarians, mobilized against it. So I'm continuing to think about the way in which libertarian ideology is doing damage. Climate change is an example of how it has caused an entirely unnecessary and avoidable catastrophe.
Yeah. It is phenomenal. I mean, certainly over here in terms of the viewpoints that we had and the discussions taking place around, sort of drilling in Alaska, et cetera. And just, again, to seem so mind-bogglingly short-sighted and insular, to put it mildly. It's just very, very difficult to actually comprehend.
Yeah, and I think that it ought to distress, I know that you largely write for a business audience, the reason why a person in business can feel reasonably secure that they are actually adding value to the world is that they know that if they were hurting people, that government would step in and stop them. But once you cripple laws against pollution, of which climate change is an example, then the business person can no longer be confident that what they are doing is necessarily a good thing. Maybe they're doing more harm than good. It's hard for the individual business person to think about that. You need regulation to make sure that what you are doing is okay.
In terms of what one is doing is okay, leading the good life and all the rest of it, or trying to do so. Now, obviously, we've spoken about Hayek so far, but and a couple of others. But in terms of your own, pet philosophers, your favourites, be they either political or otherwise, go on then. Any ones that you would like to talk about?
Well, I've spent a lot of time looking at the Harvard philosopher John Rawls, who is, I guess, the thinker who libertarians hate the most, because he is not especially respectful of property rights. He hasn't got any principled objection to government regulation. Rawls's fundamental commitment is for members of society to be able to live together in respectful relations. And so that means that whatever distribution of property you've got has got to be consistent with that. Because, you know, property is just an artifact of law. It's only because of law that we know what property belongs to whom. There mm-hmm. are earlier social contract theorists who think that, you know, we have our property before we enter society. But it's really kind of a silly narrative. At time one, I was sitting in the state of nature with my Charles Schwab brokerage account. Just doesn't make any sense. So what Rawls proposes is that we should try to think about what kinds of terms of living together we would agree to if we didn't know about any of the contingencies that divide us, if we didn't know what position in society we were going to be in, whether we were male or female, white or black, what terms would we agree to? And relevant to libertarianism, he argues that if we were making an agreement on that basis, we certainly wouldn't tolerate such radical inequalities of wealth that some people are starving, or for that matter, where some people can't get what they need to stay alive, which brings us back to the question of medical care. I think that this is a useful framework for thinking about how we are going to live together. I have particular quibbles with Rawls about his understanding of capitalism and free markets, and mm-hmm. I've also published some papers this year about that. But the overall framework seems to be the right one. What could we agree to? Because ultimately, if we're all going to live together and respect the laws that we live under, you and me right now have to agree to the laws that we live under. In that respect, social contract is not at all hypothetical. It's real. You can either agree with the law you live under, or you can regard it as an alien force.
Mm. And so on that. So when you look around you, I mean, literally, physically, in the US where you are now, as opposed to theoretically looking elsewhere, I mean, who in that case, are there places that you yourself can point to and say, there's an example of a country or indeed a policy that is being enacted and is getting it right? You know, is there someone out there? Do you point to whatever it is, you know, a Denmark or a Japan or a Brazil and say, or whatever, and say, you know, that's how we should be doing it today?
I think the Scandinavian countries basically have it right. They have go-go capitalism. Sweden has more billionaires per capita than the United States. But at the same time, really robust welfare state, so that if you are doing something that doesn't generate a lot of income, if let's say you're a professional musician, it's a very tough gig to be in for most musicians, you will nonetheless live indoors and you will have enough to eat and you will not be terrified about your economic future, and you'll be able to expect that your kids will get a decent education and have decent prospects. Mm-hmm. I think that's the way to do it. And so in the United States, I'm a big fan of what Biden has done. We've done pretty vigorous measures to respond to climate change and pretty vigorous measures against poverty. I think he's doing a pretty good job of managing the economy. I wish that he was in a different political world because at this point, the Republicans are in control of the House of Representatives, and the key votes among them are so libertarian, so skeptical of the state, that But they are not kidding when they say that they would allow the United States government to default on its debts and throw the world economy into a depression. They just don't care. I blame bad philosophy. As a political philosopher, I think that a lot of this is our fault. Bad political philosophers.
So go on, then give us a few more good ones then. He's mentioning the rules, perhaps elsewhere or going back. Do we go back to Rousseau elsewhere? Or
Historically, in many respects, I am a fan of John Stuart Mill. I think that the idea that that he develops in Chapter 3 of On Liberty, that people ought to be able to develop their potentialities is... I think that that is an important idea. Another philosopher, less well known on this side of the Atlantic, and I'm not sure on your side, but the British writer L.T. Hobhouse, who wrote A Defense of Liberalism, that elaborated on the policy implications of a Millian perspective, much more than Mill himself had. And you see a whole political program. So Hobhouse is, he's writing in 1911, just after the Liberal Party has won a big election in 1909. And he talks about all of the great things we're going to do. We, he says, are going to give every child in England an education. Every child in England is going to be able to go to school. So a radical idea in 1909. It is something that conservatives don't think today to challenge, although their attack on Obamacare logically has implications for that as well. After I talk about Hayek in the book, I have an extensive discussion of the more severe and uncompromising libertarians like Robert Nozick, Murray Rothbard, and Ayn Rand, who are skeptical of those activities by the state, and they offer philosophical arguments, and the philosophical arguments are no good at all, and I try to show why.
Okay, so we mentioned earlier on about the ethos is that certainly a lot of the sort of guests have spoken about through this podcast series over time from the point of view of, and I know it's a bit of a sort of a side hop, but not too much of one, into issues with regards to hope, community and resilience. And naturally, I know that you've been sort of touching on each of those so far. But in terms of just taking the first of those, so that this issue of hope in the present day, it's a huge subject, but what are your feelings there in terms of what, you know, what gives you hope? Do you have hope?
Absolutely. Well, you know, one of the biggest things that has happened in modern history, since 1870, the world poverty rate has plunged. That I think that was about 70-80% of the human race was living in $2 a day poverty in 1870, and it is less than 10% today. The remainder live in failed states that you know, very hard to figure out how to help them. But this is a great thing that has happened. And free markets have played a very large role in bringing that about. That's what Hayek is right about. And the technology, our capacity to provide for human needs is steadily advancing. The most remarkable recent illustration is the COVID vaccine. It's astounding that, you know, 2 years after this disease is discovered, there is a quite effective vaccine for it. And so people, and then we proceeded to immunize a very large part of the world. That's also remarkable. So we have impressive capacities. Our capacity to address climate change, now that finally there are incentives to do it, is produced much faster progress than we anticipated. And I guess the last basis for hope that I'd offer is just one thing that becomes clear when one studies history: nobody knows what's going to happen next. So even the bad things that seem quite entrenched, such as I was talking earlier about the Supreme Court, you have justices who are not old, who are likely to hold those offices for a long time, and who, in my view, are absolutely crazy and irresponsible. You know, things change. Either the personnel could change or Congress could change and Congress could do something about it. So I don't know what's going to happen. You know, we work in the world, we try to make the world better, and, you know, we are not in control of the whole thing. You know, you got to try. Sometimes you'll make a difference.
On that point there about, you know, you've got to try and sometimes make a difference, you mentioned COVID there as well. On an absolutely day-to-day, you know, sort of human level, one of the things that has been spoken about in an immense way in the last few years with regards to resilience is the lack of mental resilience that many people have in the student community, essentially everywhere. Is this something that you also talk about with your students? I mean, is this sort of, you know, part of the conversation or not? In terms of how to, yeah, in terms of how to build resilience and how to be a resilient individual, along with being an individual that is learning from the professor.
Mm-hmm. I try to encourage them to do their work, and I try to let them know that you know, we are all very lucky at Northwestern Law School. It's one of the elite law schools in the United States, really in the world.
Sure, sure.
And so the people at the bottom of the class are going to be fine because there's just not that much daylight here between the top and the bottom of the class. And so I tell them, you know, 10 years from now, you know, nobody's going to care what your grades are. It is the case that at Northwestern, despite our very best efforts, half of our students end up being in the bottom half of their class. So we keep trying to do something about that. Never works. So so I think that you know, they need a certain amount of confidence and faith in themselves, and this goes to, back to the issue of hope. It is you are more resilient if you just focus and try to do your work and find the gumption within yourself to do that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think it's very much a viewpoint that the great, I think, sort of Terry Eagleton sort of focuses on as well. What about, as we, and I'm fully aware of time, as we begin to move towards the end of this conversation, which I think has been so interesting, and thank you for your, so much of your time, Andrew. Come on then, what about, you know, what gives you inspiration then? So away from what you're doing right now, what do you, whatever, watch, read, listen to, or whatever?
I also think that, we're living in a great cultural renaissance where, you see impressive new music being, produced. I think that, there's high quality novels being written. There's very good political philosophy being produced. I think that this is I'm not talking about myself here. But just, you know, there are people who I work with, who I admire, even people who I disagree with, who I find, you know, they're really doing very good work. So I see in multiple areas, people holding themselves to very high standards. And, you know, in some ways it can become unhealthy. Some of the high functioning people, who I know are high functioning because they're very anxious people and it manifests in their work. But I look at the quality of what's being produced and, you know, focusing on the arts, but also in technology. You see the advances that we're seeing in medicine or in addressing climate change or in accomplishments with respect to COVID. Mm. And I think this is one of the most successful civilizations in the history of the world. Mm. And it is worldwide. You know, I talk to people, you know, people from all over the world come to India, and, you know, I will talk to somebody who's visiting here from Paraguay, and we're part of the same culture in a lot of ways, and I can make a cultural reference, and the person will get it. You know, this is an extraordinary thing, and it actually makes me a bit of a Burkean conservative, because I think that if the core idea of Burke or of Roger Scruton, who recently died. British conservative. Scruton says that the core of conservative is the idea that we've inherited good things that could easily be damaged, and we should try to preserve our inheritance.
Yeah, sure.
I think that that's right.
On that exact point that I mentioned, Scruton and indeed Burke, in terms of specifics, any particular books that you've been reading recently or currently reading that you'd like to recommend?
I just read there is a book by an economist named Bradford DeLong called Slouching Toward Utopia, which is an economic history of the world from 1870 to the present. I've got a review of it that is forthcoming in the Los Angeles Review of Books, so I had to read it pretty carefully. He's trying to give an account of just how the human race got so rich since 1870 and what the obstacles have been to that. And he's really focusing from the perspective not so much of a business person, but the kind of economist he is, I say in the review, is a professional utopian. He is trying to figure out at the level of policy what is in fact going to make the human race better off. Because that's the bottom line. So if you look through that lens, you just come back to Thatcher, who you brought up earlier. In some respects, she improved the wealth of Britain. On the other hand, there were parts of Britain which were quite prosperous when she came into office and became economically ruined and remain ruined to this day. That has to count as failure. To count as Thatcher failing to do what she promised to do. And the fundamental problem with the Hayekian model is that it's indifferent to distribution. The market, what DeLong says in his book is, markets are really good at giving people with money what they think they want. You actually can improve the human race's lot enormously by giving people with money what they think they want. But that way of putting it also shows what's left out of that.
Yeah. Which I think is a real, very sort of a Karl Popperan view as well, isn't it? It will be about sort of making the least number of people unhappy as opposed to trying to make the largest number happy. Okay, then, so anything else coming up that you can talk about?
So the other big thing that has happened in the United States is that the Supreme Court stopped protecting abortion. My view, which I've developed in some other articles, I said I was originally, before I got into libertarianism, a constitutional law teacher. My view is that abortion should be understood to be protected by the 13th Amendment of the Constitution. That's the one that abolishes slavery. If you go back and you look at the institution that the 13th Amendment prohibits, compulsion of women to bear children is not analogous to slavery before the Civil War. It is what slavery was for a very large part of the population. The 13th Amendment should be understood as a break with a very nasty part of American history, a declaration that we are not going to do that awful thing anymore. But we are doing that awful thing right now. In my view, it violates the Constitution. I've said this in some articles. I am now beginning to think about making that the next book.
Wow. And in terms of the articles, are the networks really sort of picking up on it? Are you getting people?
It has gotten more attention lately than it had before Roe was overruled. There was a bit of a kerfuffle recently because a federal judge asked the litigants to give her briefing on whether the 13th Amendment protected the right to abortion, even after the Supreme Court overruled Roe and Dobbs. And so I wrote a short piece, actually two short pieces in response to that. If anybody's interested in seeing those pieces, if they look me up on Twitter, I always post my new articles on the Twitter feed.
Fantastic. And just to be clear about what you go under on Twitter and elsewhere, they make sure they can get the right Andrew Koppelman.
It is just if you Google Andrew Koppelman Twitter, it will come right up, but it is at Andrew Koppelman, just my name, the at sign and Andrew, K-O-P-P-E-L-M-A-N. I also have a website, andrewkoppelman.com, which also will update you on that, and which has links to all of my articles.
Fantastic. Well, I mean, that has taken, I think, neatly to the end of this conversation. It's been so interesting talking with Andrew. I must say, I'm looking forward to your next book with a great deal of bated breath. But so to Andrew Koppelman, John Paul Stevens, Professor of Law, Professor of Political Science and Philosophy Department Affiliated Faculty at Northwestern University, and author of the fantastic Burning Down the House, How Libertarian Philosophy Was Corrupted by Delusion and Greed, A Lively History of American Libertarianism and Its Decay into Dangerous Fantasy. Thank you very much indeed.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to the New Abnormal podcast. Just so you know, the trends and insights discussed in these podcasts link to my speeches. Check out seanpeterc.com for more info, and to ongoing cultural and social research conducted by brandpositive.org. Till next time, goodbye.